Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, the weapon used in the assassination attempt of Donald Trump was an AR-15, a semi-automatic that is the most popular in the US. There are 20 million of them in American homes, and as such has become the physical embodiment of the gun rights issue in the US. Zusha Ellenson is a national reporter for the Wall Street Journal and co-author of American Gun, the true story of the AR-15. Zusha, good afternoon.
Thanks for having me, Sean. What a pleasure and an honour.
Pleasure and honour is all ours, I should say. Could you tell us a little bit about the history of this? Because this gun, it was the 60s where it first originated.
Absolutely. It has a fascinating history. I mean, the reason why we wrote this book is we were covering all these mass shootings. We were wondering what was this gun all these shooters were using. We started looking into the history and it just blew our minds. And I think your listeners will be very familiar with the little company where this gun was invented. It's called Armalite. Does that name ring a bell?
It does indeed, yes. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. So the inventor of the AR-15 was a guy named Eugene Stoner. And he's a guy you might not expect to be the inventor of this sort of macho-looking gun. He was a very gentle guy. He refused to spank his children. When he was really upset, he would say, "Boy, that frosts me." He never swore. And all he thought about was new ideas for guns. He'd be out to dinner with his wife in Los Angeles, and he'd be drawing gun designs on the tablecloth. And his wife would say, "You can't draw here." He said, "It's fine. It'll wash out. It'll wash out. It's fine." But what he did in his garage in Los Angeles was nothing short of revolutionizing the whole firearms industry. He devised, with no training, no college education, this gun that was very lightweight, made of lightweight materials, modern materials like aluminum, plastic, and fiberglass, and had a very ingenious internal system. And the result was just an easy-to-shoot, lightweight gun that was way ahead of its time.
Mm. And though to get it, at least to be used by the armed forces in the US, took a bit of schmoozing, as I understand.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What a tale of, you know, it involves a bunch of, as you say, schmoozy businessmen, spies, you know, some questionable relationships between government officials and arms dealers. But what's fascinating is what was happening at the world at the time is that U.S. military officials were very worried about the threat of communist guerrillas armed with AK-47s, and they wanted a gun that could counter that. And so they looked to Stoner to devise this gun that could, you know, basically fire a lot of lead at close range. I mean, for a long time, U.S. soldiers had been outfitted with these long range rifles that could shoot, you know, a country mile, very accurate. Now they wanted something that could fire a lot of lead. And that eventually became the M16 that's been, you know, used. Various versions of it have been used by the U.S. military for decades. Mm. But let me tell you, once this gun got on the battlefield, it was a complete disaster. So as you know, in bureaucracies, there's always big egos, right? And so there were people who didn't want this little guy Stoner making the gun for the military. They did everything they could to undermine him. They rigged the tests. They met with his guns. When it was finally adopted, they made a ton of changes to his gun so that by the time it went to the battlefield in Vietnam, it didn't really work. There were really tragic stories that we found out about soldiers dying with the jammed rifle in their hands. And it became a big scandal in the U.S. There were congressional hearings. There was, you know, outraged parents. There were letters to the editor. And it was really just forgotten because the 60s were so wild. But at the time, it was a huge scandal.
Yeah. Now, I suppose that draws a line there in that there's two halves to this story. It seems to have been a disaster in Vietnam and a busted flush. But then people who, I suppose, wanted to make money set about trying to make it more popular. How did they do that?
Oh, this is such a fascinating story because it started out as a gun that was despised, that was hated by American gun owners. You know, in the beginning, hunters looked at this gun, which was sold by Colt. They tried to market it as a superb hunting partner, but hunters didn't want it. They liked their wooden, you know, wood-stocked, gleaming steel hunting rifles. They prided themselves on accuracy. They liked the long distance they could use with their hunting rifles. They also, you know, the caliber was small. So this was very much looked down upon at first, and it was really a niche product. And it really attracted a lot of groups, militant groups, radical groups. I mean, the IRA liked Armalites, obviously. You had groups here, radical groups who liked the gun. And, you know, in the 80s and 90s, it became a gun used by cults, by gangsters, all this sort of thing, to the point where the U.S. government said, this is a gun being used by the bad guys and we're going to outlaw it. But what happened when the U.S. government tried to outlaw is it actually sparked interest from people. In 1994, guess how many AR-15s were in the U.S.? There were 400,000. Now, today, there's over 20 million. So that's all happened in, you know, three decades. It started with the government trying to ban the gun. That sparked a lot of interest. And surprisingly, during the 10 years that it was banned in the U.S., because of the way the law was written so poorly, they actually made more AR-15s than they had made in the previous 30 years. So the industry really started getting going.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I know, because I was just wondering about that ban. Like, it wasn't really, why was it not really a ban?
Well, what's interesting is if you look at other countries around the world, they've, like Australia, New Zealand, et cetera, they've banned whole classes of semi-automatic firearms. They're basically like, if this is a semi-automatic rifle, you can't have it. But the U.S., because of the very, you know, strong gun rights movement, we have the Second Amendment in our Constitution that a lot of other countries don't have. And so when they were sort of constructing this ban, they tried to they thought they were doing something to compromise with the gun rights people. And they wrote a very, very, very carefully worded definition of what this gun was. They called it an assault weapon. But gun makers got around it very quickly. It took them no time. It was as holy as Swiss cheese, this
yeah,
law.
Yeah.
And so they started producing AR-15s that looked just a little different than the ones they made before the ban.
And marketing seems to have a lot to do with this. Is it true that video games will feature particular sorts of weapons, which in turn will fuel sales of those actual weapons?
Oh, my goodness. One of the most fascinating things we found out in researching our book, which is called American Gun, The True Story of the AR-15, as you mentioned, was that there were these deals between video game makers and gun companies to place their products in the video games, name brand products, sort of like how, you know, you have, you know, in movies, you'll have cars that are placed there. You'll have any other number of products. So what happened is that these guns started showing up in Call of Duty, which is one of the most famous video games. A lot of people play it. And people wondered, why did that happen? We got our hands on internal company emails from one of the biggest gun companies at the time, where they talk about why they wanted to put their product in this video game. And what they said is they wanted to basically market to the next generation of shooters. They wanted people who were, you know, turning 18 to recognize their brand and go out and buy their gun.
That's extraordinary. Now, though,